want the Republicans to wake up is what the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live.
Now, from the Left Coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
I want to thank the voluntary subscribers to the Peter B. Collins Show, like Nancy Mrazek, Andrew Rush, David Pennell, and Mary Gruber. And I could use a few more. Things are a little tight here in paying for the costs of the podcast and the web hosting and all that stuff. So if you haven't signed up and you're financially able, no guilt, but I invite you to show your support and show me how you value the work we do here. Just go to peterbcollins.com and the links are on the right-hand side of the homepage. Our voluntary subscriptions start at just $5 a month. Have you Googled yet today? Maybe you did a search, you checked your email, did some chat. Google is a powerful force in American life today, and Stephen Levy's written a powerful new book about Google and the Googlers. He is our single guest in today's podcast. In our first segment today, we take a look at the giant but very fresh young company called Google. Stephen Levy has been covering Silicon Valley companies, including Apple, and he wrote a book about hackers years ago. His new one is called In the Plex, How Google Thinks, Works, and Shapes Our Lives. Stephen Levy, welcome to the Peter B. Collins Show.
Thank you.
And this is a powerful book. I read it while I was on vacation this summer, and I found it very informative, very enjoyable. And you also raise a number of issues that we'll cover during our conversation here about what Google could become in both best case and worst case scenarios. But let's start a little bit with the founders and with the culture that they have created. And let me disclose that I have a slight insider's view. My stepson has worked three tours as a summer intern for Google, and so I've been to the campus, but he is unwilling to disclose any secrets to me, including where their server farms are located. I did get some free meals out of it, though, and that's
those are the more important servers at Google.
That's a very good point. Tell us a little bit about Larry, and does he? I've never known whether he says Sergey or Sergey. Sergey Brin.
Sergey Brin.
Okay, Larry Page and Sergey Brin. They met at Stanford University. And the founding of Google is quite an amazing story that you detail in a very interesting narrative in your book.
Yeah, what's fascinating about it is, like a lot of things, it's owed in part to a rise of technology, particularly the internet, and computer algorithms, artificial intelligence, but in part because the youth of its founders enabled them to see an opportunity when people who were in the established business didn't understand how powerful search could be or how far search had to go, really. Larry at first, and then Sergey joined him, developed this system that turned out to be an amazing way to find what you wanted on the web, to find information anywhere on the World Wide Web in a very short period of time, very efficiently and very accurately. And when they showed it around, they originally wanted to sell it to another company, license it. The other companies weren't interested. They thought either search was a solved problem or that it would be a handicap to their businesses to have search that was too effective, because then people would go somewhere else and they found what they were looking for, and they would leave the portal site that they did the search on. So they had, Larry and Sergey had no choice but to start a company after that.
Mm-hmm. And the history, which is fairly brief, of the Internet and search engines is littered with casualties. I remember Excite, Alta Vista. Ask.com is still there, but it never really achieved the stratosphere like Yahoo and Google did. Yahoo's on its knees, just fired its CEO as just a couple of days before we're speaking here. And so it is amazing that they were able to take this concept and not only leap over the early entries into the category, but also the critical part, as they say in Silicon Valley, of monetizing the technology. And this is really where Google leapt over its competitors, isn't it?
That's right. When they first started as a company, they didn't have that firm an idea of how they would make their money or how much money would come in. They just felt that this thing was so useful that there would be a way to monetize it, maybe with ads, maybe with licensing the technology to other companies, maybe building some of their own hardware so companies could build their Google-in-a-box things so people could search the internal intranet of a company, and they would sell them the hardware to do that. But what happened was that they came up with an ad system that was very sophisticated and very powerful and specifically geared to take advantage of both the idea that people were searching for things and were in a mood to buy things when they searched, and delivering them just the right ad was important. But also it took advantage of the economics of the Internet in a very clever way, and conformed with what seemed to be an idealistic and unrealistic expectation on the part of the founders that their ads were going to be useful and welcome to people as opposed to intrusions, which most ads are. And they came up with this very novel system that allowed them to do all those things, and it turned out to be really the most successful product in the history of the Internet in terms of monetization.
Stephen Levy, I used to live in Palo Alto, Menlo Park. I was there in the 70s and 80s. And so I know the proximity of Stanford University to Sand Hill Road. Sand Hill Road is the exit off Highway 280 that takes you to the Stanford campus. Mm-hmm. And it's where the venture capitalists have all congregated in some nice, fairly nice office buildings there in a very beautiful setting. And I'm curious if you could describe for our listeners how these two young students, very bright engineering students, managed to navigate the minefield of venture capital to get the company started up, but to retain sufficient control so that they were in a great position when they finally took it public.
So Google started talking to venture capitalists in 1998, the end of 1998, beginning of 1999. And this was the end of the boom. Of course, people didn't know it was the end of the boom. They thought the boom was just going to continue. I worked for a magazine which was publishing things about the long boom, and everyone was very optimistic there. So they were in a great position in terms of timing to get venture capitalists interested. And they were the kind of people that venture capitalists really like to see, super smart, ambitious young people from Stanford with a strong technical background, a great idea, and the confidence to pull it off. And when they showed up at Kleiner Perkins, which is one of the premier venture capital firms, John Doerr, who is the king of venture capital in Silicon Valley, was very impressed with them. Still, he didn't think it was going to be one of the biggest companies ever. And he recounted to me that when Larry and Sergey gave their little pitch to him. He asked how big a company it could be, and you know, he thought maybe this could be worth $1 billion. And you know, at most, it was his thinking. But you know, Larry said $10 billion, and he thought, wow, $10 billion in revenues. That's a lot, and you know, or in market cap. And he said, no, in revenues, meaning it would be a much bigger company ever thought. And he said that was a crazy thing to say. It could be worth that much. And of course, now it's $30 billion in revenues and, you know, well over $200 billion in market cap. They, you know, that impressed John a lot. And Google did something else, which was very unusual, is that they weren't satisfied with just the premier venture capital firm in Silicon Valley. They wanted the other premier firm, Sequoia, to also be part of the deal there. So what they did was they went to Mike Moritz, who had funded Yahoo, and got him to sign on too, and basically said to both of these firms, well, we'll do it, but we want both of you to participate, to be co-lead investors there, which was very, very unusual. Mm-hmm. But they were both so eager to do it, both for venture capitalists, that they agreed to do that, even though there was a lot of quibbling over, you know, who would get big, better placement in the press release.
Now, I give them a lot of credit. The name Google is distinct. It's easy to grasp. It has become a verb, to Google. You explain in the book the origin of the name. Tell our listeners, please.
Well, there's a thing in a mathematical term called a Googleplex, which is technically the numeral 1 followed by 100 zeros. It's a very big number. And that conformed to the way Google operated because it dealt in very, very big numbers of math. What they did was basically capture the entire World Wide Web and use some pretty sophisticated mathematics to figure out the relationship of web pages by their links in order to determine which ones were the more important ones for a given search term. So that really fit there, and you know, because they were, you know, getting millions of pages, eventually billions of pages into their index, and doing these calculations that really, you know, looked at everything on the web when you typed in a search term. And of course, the misspelling was because the original spelling of Google, which, you know, isn't quite the same,
right?
You know, you don't have that double O, was taken in the web domain. So they had their own spelling there.
Somebody had already grabbed it, huh?
Yeah, and which is better for Google. If you're doing a trademark, you want your unique spelling there, so you know, people won't claim that a rival product has to deal with the actual thing you're describing, as opposed to the unique name.
Stephen, your book gives great anecdotes from the early days of Google. And just one that I want to focus on that we already touched on, the food service that is a hallmark of its, and it's free for employees, is remarkable. And they hired a chef when they had only 12 employees. They were planning for this kind of Google plantation from very early stages.
Right. Yeah, and it was amazing. I talked to a number of people who visited them when they were a very small company. And they were very ambitious in their hiring. They hired the people who had been working for Bell Labs or other big research firms, with, you know, really top engineers. And you know, they hired a guy from Oracle to handle their real estate and setting up buildings when they were still in a little office over a bicycle shop. And everyone was blown away by their saying very emphatically, "We're going to grow to this size. We're going to have 5,000 employees in a few years, and then we'll be in X amount of countries." And those things actually turned out to be true. As in terms of a chef, this was something that they thought would be good for their employees. And it really dated back to their very first location, where they rented a half of a house from a friend of Sergey's girlfriend. And the woman who was their landlord in the house is now works at Google, and she's the head of their ad division. At one point, a refrigerator was delivered, and you know, Susan, the woman with the house, thought, "Oh, good, it's good to have someone in the house that could accept the delivery of the refrigerator." But they hadn't delivered to their side of the house to store the food. And that was the beginning of free food at Google. And it carried over when they did auditions for a chef, and the guy they hired, Charlie Ayers, he had done some cooking for the Grateful Dead. He was never the full-time chef for the Grateful Dead, but that description stuck, and everyone thought that you know Grateful Dead food was served at Google all the time, and it became the forerunner of multiple cafes on the Google campus. The very first one they started, the Grew was Google Grew, and I think there's something like 24 cafes now on campus.
Well, and to what extent were they trying to outdo Apple? Because for me, Apple was the first Silicon Valley company that had popcorn machines and free sodas, and there was on every floor there was a little corner where there were video games and beanbag chairs. Do you think they were directly thinking about doing things at a higher level than Apple, or was this broader in terms of other Silicon Valley companies providing these types of amenities for workers?
I think it was somewhat broader, and then Apple. The things you mentioned there weren't distributed all throughout Apple. I remember the Macintosh group had special perks that other groups didn't have at Apple. And, and the food to this day is not free at Apple. They have a terrific cafeteria, and you buy at below market prices, but you still pull out your card, or pay some money for the food at Apple. I think that it was more along the model of a university, where you'd have your meal plan. Only the company was paying for the meal plan. Mm-hmm. So both of them really grew up in academia. Both their parents were academics, Larry and Sergey, and met at Stanford, and they really saw the campus as an extension of college life, where everything's taken care of there. It's sort of a combination between that and Montessori school, which is another thread is shared by both of the founders.
Well, and I use the term plantation not in a mean way, but that everything that you need is there, and including doing your laundry. There's a gym and a lap pool, and you can get a haircut on campus. You can charge your electric car. All these things are taken care of. But to me, it's a way of extracting greater productivity and getting people to spend much longer hours in the workplace.
Yeah, I find that fascinating. I think that Google's very happy with this, and I wonder whether some people dismiss it and saying, "Well, yeah, Google makes a lot of money; they could afford to do that." But I wonder if Google's correct and people are more productive. And certainly, you could argue that like when I did the book, maybe it's a little more now. That it was about $17 per employee per day to provide this free food. When you think about it, how long it takes people just to leave the campus to get lunch, right? Mm-hmm. That's going to be, probably take an hour out of the day, in addition just the time you sit there and eat the food. So that to get $17 an hour for an hour of extra work, it's pretty darn good investment there.
Yeah.
So why don't companies, even companies that aren't so rich, even companies that struggle, do that? Because if the productivity is going to be worth it, it will be worthwhile to do. I think that would be interesting. When I was doing the book, I would be on the Google campus. I'd spend a lot of time there. Then I'd go back to Newsweek, which was or Wired, and think of Newsweek's cafeteria. It was almost like a high school cafeteria, and we had to pay. It wasn't really an enticing thing, and quite often we'd leave Newsweek and go out to eat and spend some money. Originally it was Newsweek's money, but then they clamped down on expenses. but I thought, why doesn't even the struggling publishing industry do something nicer. Mm-hmm. Here at Condé Nast, where Wired is located, there's a lovely cafeteria, and they charge a pretty good price, but it's still it's not free, and we don't have the mini kitchens, and we can't do our laundry here or things like that. Why shouldn't every company do that? What is the payback? Would it really be worth it?
Yeah. No, I think it's a very interesting concept, and it's certainly attractive from the outside. You mentioned the Montessori connection, that both Larry and Sergey were a Montessori product. And this leads to a discussion of the criteria that they've set for most employees. They do make some exceptions. But I'll give you one example. I have a friend who is an extremely successful radio ad salesperson and sales manager. And a few years ago, Google purchased a company called DMARC that was engaged in a pretty interesting approach, and Google has expanded on it, to sell the unsold advertising inventory on commercial radio stations. But my friend Lynn thought she was going to be a Google employee, and then they started to ask her what her college GPA was and how she had scored on the SAT at the age of 17. And she tried to fumble and, change the subject and say, gosh, do we really have to look that far back? I mean, this is a 45-year-old woman. And they said, oh, yes, we look at everything. And she ultimately washed out because I think she had like only a 3.2 grade point average at a fairly decent university. So talk a little bit about the culture they've created and the way they've attracted really smart, often Mensa-qualified people as Google employees.
Yeah, no, that's a great story you told them. Pretty interesting. I mean, Google, in that case, actually spent $900 million for that company, the DMARC, and they found they really couldn't do what they wanted to do and wrote the whole thing off eventually. But I talked to any number of people who were in their 30s, 40s, even beyond, who were asked those same questions. You know, what's your GPA? What's your SAT score? And the explanation that I got for that was, well, we use the GPAs to see how hard you work, and we use the SATs to see how smart you are. Google wants people who are very smart. And the standard is that you have to be able to, be fascinating if Larry is stuck in an airport with you. But also, they want to make sure that everything, the level of all the employees is at a uniformly high intelligence, so no one is sitting there listening to some moron rail on, and no one has to take orders from someone who is dumber than they are. That's a very demoralizing thing there.
I know a lot of people who are academically very intelligent, but they're socially inept, or they're one-dimensional individuals.
Well, it is interesting, and I think there can be exceptions. One exception that they do make is that if you've done something really extraordinary, you could kind of slip in. There was one person, for instance, I tell the story that didn't have all the scores, and Google takes his data very seriously, but it turned out he was the foosball champion of Italy. And Sergey thought, well, that's pretty good. You have to work hard at that, and that's pretty interesting. So he got hired. For a lot of people, I think Google does shut itself out. And particularly, you mentioned what school your firm went to. They're very selective on what schools they recruit from and what schools you're from. And I've talked to people in human, people relations, they call it, human resources at Google. And, they sort of fight against this because they understand that maybe the best student at Brooklyn College is better than the 50th best student at Stanford.
Yeah, very interesting. Now, have you seen any indications that these brainy people have problems working together? Because many of them are out there, in very advanced fields of engineering and development of new technologies. And I can imagine that it's very hard to get those clouds all in the same sky.
Well, actually, Google does a pretty good job of that, and I think that's because one thing they emphasize is that the decisions should be made on the basis of data and not by politics and, you know, who speaks the loudest in the room there. And it's impossible to avoid politics in any kind of big corporation. But still, because they hire people who really respect data, you know, and can understand when the data dictates one direction or another, that they've had pretty good success at managing a lot of the meetings to have the decision that carries the day, the one where people were able to present the most compelling information to back up what they said, rather than just shout the loudest or pull rank on you. What they wanted to do, and it doesn't happen all the time, but I think they managed to make it happen more than in other corporations, because this is something they emphasize, is that someone in a relatively low position, a relatively new person, could successfully get his or her point of view across if that person brings in the evidence to say why, you know, that person's view should be the one to carry the day.
Mm-hmm. One of the most intriguing aspects is the commitment of the commanders, the geeks in chief, to innovation. And they seem to be those kind of science kids who just revel in it. And the idea of setting aside 20%, one-fifth of each full-time employee's work days, and saying you can pursue any approved project that is aimed at, you know, developing some innovation. And I'd like you to talk a little bit about that and see if you could cite a couple of examples of how this investment company-wide has paid off.
Yeah, and you said it doesn't even have to be approved. That's the key. You can work on something, and you don't need someone's okay.
Oh, I thought there was some sort of supervisorial requirement that you had to check in with somebody and let them know what you're doing.
Basically, the idea is that you assign yourself. Maybe if it's something illegal or something which is totally ridiculous, someone would say no. But you have a lot of autonomy to pretty much pursue what you want in that 20% time. Now, some of the cynical Googlers have mentioned that, well, we don't really get excused from our work. Our work really isn't 80%. It's like 100%. So they say the joke that's 120% time. That's taken on, but since people spend a lot of time there anyway, that's maybe they would spend 120% of a work week working on assigned stuff. This way, they get to spend 100% on what they're supposed to do, and the extra 20% on a thing of their own choosing. And some important projects at Google have been come out of the 20% time, including Google News. That was a 20% project, and the first social networking system at Google called Orkut, which didn't work out too well, except in Brazil, where it's like almost synonymous with the internet. But that was from a 20% project. Ironically, if that project had not been a 20% project, it would have been written on a normal Google code base instead of on the Microsoft .NET system, which when Google adopted it as a project, they had to rewrite it a lot. And a lot of the energy in the initial days of the Orkut project were taken up by trying to make that shift instead of promoting it worldwide. Maybe that hurt it becoming really what Facebook had to do, because it's sort of weird that the Orkut was rolled out just about the same time that Mark Zuckerberg at Harvard invented Facebook.
Stephen Levy, in the book, you describe that, we touched earlier on the unorthodox approach to venture capital, that they wanted both Kleiner and Sequoia to be co-leaders of the early investments. And they also went public in their own way, and as you describe in the book, was almost derailed by the publication of a Playboy magazine interview. Tell us that anecdote.
Yeah, that's especially relevant since we saw kind of a really similar thing happen to Groupon just this year. But when they went public, they were determined to do it as they do everything else, their way. So instead of the normal way of having your underwriter set a price and friends and family and privileged people would get to buy at that price, and then later in the day the thing would just skyrocket to four or five times the price, they thought they would do it by auction. And, you know, Google uses auction as ad system. It thinks it's a fair way to do things. So they would basically let the small investor get in on that initial price. And Wall Street didn't like that. They fought against it. They also said that, you know, that if you're going to invest in Google, you have to understand that we're not going to go for short-term gains. We're going to go for the long-term. We're not going to report, you know, what we expect to do in the next quarter all the time. It's something that you're going to have to figure out for yourself. And, you know, so, but the SEC, you know, was not cool with a lot of the unorthodox things they were doing. And one of the things was this Playboy interview that came up at the last minute, which they didn't really inform the SEC about. And, you know, in part it came up because they actually gave the interview a little before they filed for the IPO and didn't realize, you know, when the publication would happen. And
they thought they'd have to sit for their centerfold photos before it would actually go out, right?
Well, you know, I read Playboy for the SEC reports, you know, because I usually used to say. But as it turned out, because the actual date of the IPO was postponed because they had to answer for the SEC for this or the SEC for that, that Playboy got to publish before they came out, and it was kind of embarrassing. And the only way they were able to get around it, because the SEC doesn't like you to share things in public like that when you're filing for an IPO, was they agreed to put the entire Playboy interview, not the pictures in the rest of the magazine, but just the interview as part of the filing, as an amendment there. So,
well, you know, I think they should have included
on the SEC website, you can see the Playboy interview with Larry and Sergey now.
Well, they should have included the Playboy advisor, but flagged it as certain forward-looking statements.
Oh, my Lord.
Stephen, the slogan, don't be evil, is pretty widely known as the mantra of Google. And the episode that so far has flown in the face most vividly was their effort to deal with the Chinese government and come up with a compromised system to allow censorship of search results in order to comply with the dictates of the Chinese regime. And ultimately, Google pulled out of China. But describe what they went through in that process and how it created certain camps internally of people who were very uncomfortable with the compromises they had to accept in order to do business in China.
Right. So I spent a lot of time, you know, talking about that. I really spent time in China at Google and you know, talking to employees and talking to people outside the company and to really tell the story of what happened with Google in China. And they started off really with, as you mentioned, this huge compromise. Here's a company that has spent an amazing amount of energy and innovation and, you know, imagination and data processing to deliver the most relevant results to anything that someone would type into that search box when they went to Google. And here they were now asked to deny the most relevant results in a lot of cases to people who in China who were searching for things, and even worse, to do it in the service of an oppressive government. It didn't want them to get important information about politics and about protesters, about what was happening in the country there. So that's a terrible compromise, and a particularly terrible compromise for Sergey Brin, whose personal history is interesting there. He came over as a small child from Russia when his family was fleeing oppression and anti-Semitism. So this is very personal for him. But Google rationalized this entry into China by saying that even though we have to do this censorship, we feel that in the long run we're going to be doing good for China. We will get more information in there, and we'll tell people when we're not giving them all the results. You know, so maybe people will push back against the government. But they underestimated, really, that the continuing nature of the compromises that they would have to take when they were there. The Chinese government kept asking for more censorship, and demanded even at one point that they censored their Chinese language search outside of China, and they couldn't bring some of their best services into China, like Gmail or their documents, because they didn't want the Chinese government to be able to get hold of that stuff and violate the privacy of Google's users there. And it just got worse and worse. The government tilted the scales against them in a competition with their competitor Baidu. So as the time went on, some people at Google, as you mentioned, became disenchanted and began arguing that maybe we should reconsider this. So in the end of 2009, when Google was attacked by dark side hackers who were almost certainly supported by, if not working for, the Chinese government, that was the last straw, as people said. And Google sort of got its moral mojo back by taking a stand and saying, we won't do this anymore. We're not leaving China, but we're going to stop censoring results, which meant, of course, they had to leave China because they couldn't get a license to continue the search engine otherwise. But they made China do that, and they held a moral stand. And by contrast, companies like Microsoft that stood behind the excuse that we're just following Chinese law, really didn't look like they were too moral.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Murdoch, News Corp, still operating there with censored coverage on satellite television.
Well, I don't think of, don't be evil is going to be the unofficial motto of News Corp.
I'm sure James Murdoch repeats it over and over again as he's being prepped for his next parliamentary appearance.
Yeah. I didn't hear it that time.
Now, one of the anecdotes related to China is an unusual hearing before Tom Lantos, who's no longer with us. He was a congressman, Holocaust survivor, originally from Hungary, represented the area just north of Silicon Valley here in the Bay Area. And I knew Tom Lantos, and even on a good day, he could be a real son of a bitch. But he took after Google related to China in a very hard-hitting way.
Yeah, and this is when Google was just about to go in there and unveil, their search engine there. They had announced they were going to do this, and there was a hearing in Congress in 2006, and it was Google and Microsoft and Cisco and Yahoo had to stand up there and all those executives from each company had to hold up their right hand, take the oath like they were, cigarette executives or mafiosa or something like that.
Or baseball players on steroids.
and Lantos, took them on one by one. They made a direct comparison to companies cooperating with Germany during the Holocaust. And a book had just come out around that time called IBM and the Holocaust, which said some shameful things that IBM did. And he made that connection, which I thought was kind of interesting because the person who was representing Google is a fellow named Elliot Schrag, who's family had lost members during the Holocaust. So, this was an interesting moment for him being accused of this kind of behavior there. And Lantos, I actually was at that hearing, and it was amazing because Lantos, was made each of the executives, and the Google one, the Yahoo one, everything, ask them, are you ashamed? Aren't you ashamed of what your company is doing? And each one had to answer him individually there. And that was really tough for them. And, and as I said in the book, they said, no, we're doing this. We feel that overall we're doing good, et cetera. But I said those words rang in their ears for a long time. And I think, it was quite a scene setter for what eventually happened.
Stephen, is there any estimate for what Google lost on the China effort?
Well, it's hard to say because even though that they were, building the business, they were funding. I don't know if they were actually making much money in China, but since China is, right now, is the biggest internet market in the world in terms of users, there's a lot of value there of being even the runner-up in search and to be an important part of the internet in China. They're still there, but without search on the Chinese mainland, it really takes the wind out of their sails.
Mm-hmm.
So it was something that they did, you know, it was a financial loss, and you know, some of the shareholders actually, you know, complained about it. But this was what Google had promised. They said that sometimes for the good of humanity, we will make less money. We will do things that the shareholders might not like. And this is something that you have to accept if you hold stock in Google.
Stephen, aside from the China effort, one of the other big setbacks for Google was their effort to get into online video with Google TV. And they enjoy a very good PR image, and most people know much more about their successes than their flops. But they basically papered over their failure with Google TV by buying YouTube.
Well, no, actually, there was a Google Video, I think you're referring to there, right? Yeah, so Google TV, you know, there's so many things in Google that...
You're correct. I think I've jumbled those
so
together.
A project called Google Video. Mm-hmm. I can see it's confusing because later on they started one called Google TV, which also isn't very successful, but they're still working at that one. But Google Video was not very successful, and it was interesting. I really tracked this because I found it fascinating that it showed even in 2005 when Google is trying to do its video product, it had already become a big enough company that it wasn't able to move as fastly, as nimbly, and as freely as a small startup was, because around the same time there was this little company called YouTube over a pizza shop that was basically whipping Google's butt on video on the internet. They had a better plan. They weren't so concerned about pleasing the content holders and offending people. And the people at Google Video, and I was able to see all the emails about this because there was a lawsuit later on involving YouTube and Google Video. That they were interested about preparing their presentation to show to Larry and Sergey and Eric Schmidt, the CEO, and their bosses to explain what they were doing. Whereas the YouTube people, they didn't have any bosses. They were just a few kids having a great time and not worrying too much about whether their users were copying copyrighted content. Basically, just building up traffic and having a great time. And, Google finally said, I give up. We're going to buy YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
Which turned out to be a pretty good purchase, I have to say, though. And Google was smart, after it bought YouTube, not to integrate YouTube on the Mountain View campus. They let them stay up of, like a little north campus in San Bruno. They didn't change the name to Google Video and fold it in there. It was still YouTube. YouTube is a valuable franchise now.
So Google has had let's say the relationship with Apple has changed sharply since both companies went into the telephone business, the wireless phone business. But early on, there was quite a love fest between Apple and Google. They had board members on each other's boards, and it appeared to be a friendly competitive situation in the Valley. Tell us how the iPhone and the Android have changed all that.
Right. Well, as you say, it was a beautiful friendship. Steve Jobs, the CEO of Apple, thought that here's a company with complementary products that Apple wasn't competing in. Apple didn't have a search engine, and Apple didn't have a video operation. They have their iTunes, but it wasn't online video like that, user generated, and he thought that this was a great way for those two companies to cooperate and have a partnership and square off against Microsoft together there. But after Google started developing its phone, Steve began to have suspicions of, you know, what's going on here. And when he finally saw what the phone was going to be, and, you know, after he came out with his iPhone in 2007, Google accelerated their plans to come out with a more advanced phone on the Android phone they originally planned. And Steve, you know, was very unhappy. He felt that, you know, really he was betrayed by Google, and the relationship went downhill very, very quickly, to the point where Steve addressed the employees of Apple and said that, you know, that Google is just out for itself, and he mocked the "Don't Be Evil" slogan. And you know, Eric Schmidt had, you know, the Google CEO had to leave the board, and other people who, you know, served both companies on boards or whatever had to choose between one or the other. And it was a pretty contentious split there, and no love was lost even now between the two companies.
And, Stephen, what's your comment on the $12 billion purchase of Motorola's mobile assets? And are the patents, I believe there's some 17,000 or more patents held by Motorola, are they an asset to Google in a positive way, or an asset to fend off any patent-related lawsuits related to their you know, innovation in the wireless telephone smartphone space?
I think it's more the latter. You know, we're in an unfortunate position in general when it comes to patents. In the, you know, the point of patents was to expand innovation, but now more often than not, patents people no one ever heard of are being used to block projects, and try to stop products in their tracks, and quite often by companies that don't even make anything and just, you know, get hold of patents and start suing people there. And, you know, that's a big problem, and it's particularly a problem which is, you know, present in smartphones. Someone once estimated there's like 250,000 patents involved potentially in just one given smartphone. So you figure that if someone had to pay a dollar license fee for every patent, it would cost $250,000 to buy your iPhone or your Android phone. This is a big problem. What normally happens is the companies attempt to get their own patents for a mutually assured destruction. They say, well, you won't sue us, I won't sue you, and then we'll get by with that. And Google, being a young company, didn't have as many patents, so they had to get their own. But the purchase of Motorola Mobility is a typical thing from Larry Page, who's a big thinker. He's very ambitious. And his way out of a problem is to come up with a solution that's bigger than the problem. So by coming up with the problem of how we're going to get more patents, what he wound up was not only buying a patent portfolio, but a giant company that came with it. Now he has to figure out what to do with a big company of 19,000 employees that operate by making, hardware, like, you know, physical handsets, which is something Google hasn't really done too much of in the past there. So that's going to be a challenge for him. But, big projects and big risks are something that Larry really likes.
Stephen, I just want to touch briefly on the Books project and the current status. There was a three-year series of lawsuits that were settled. And what is the...
Settled, but still not settled.
Okay, well, tell us the current status of the ambitious project to digitize every book ever published.
Right. Well, that was a similar way that Google wanted out of it. They had this, plan to scan every book ever published in the world, and then, you know, put it in their indexes. So when you type the search query and something relevant in any book ever published came up, you would get, you know, like a few lines from that book, and it'd tell you about that. And, of course, the publishers and the authors felt that Google was exploiting their work by that, and they sued Google, and Google settled, not only to settle that immediate question, but, you know, wound up becoming the sole, vendor of, you know, books that were out of print but still in copyright. That settlement got challenged in court and eventually got overturned. And, you know, the judge is still waiting to hear, even a couple of years later, where Google and the authors and publishers are going to come down on that, whether they're going to adjust their settlement or go back to court on that. And the whole thing, to me, is sad, because I actually think that Google's plan could have been, really good for people. They took this this course that got made things complicated and had to sell things. And it's also interesting to see how people lined up against Google in this lawsuit. Many of groups, testified against it. Privacy groups, writers groups, and other people who you would think of might be allies of Google. And it just showed that Google, as a big company, isn't as lovable as it was. It was a small, scrappy company, and it's powerful enough now that people are worried about it. And every time they take on something, people get more worried that its powers will be expanded, and Google will know more about us and might go unchecked if they did abuse its power.
Well, Stephen, that's exactly where I wanted to go for our closing comments here, because I'm really impressed with Google, and my I get caught up in a kind of spirit of innovation and entrepreneurship, and I just want to say this is all great. But I'm also a hardliner about our constitutional and privacy rights, and I deplore the way our government has sharply curtailed them since 9/11. And I'll just cite the ongoing massive wiretapping and diversion of electronic traffic, both voice and text, by the NSA. That continues and is no longer controversial. When I talk to members of Congress and I say, I want my Fourth Amendment rights back, they look at me like, what the hell are you talking about? And so I can see it very sharply in terms of the data that government has been collecting on us, mostly in an involuntary manner. They didn't get my consent for it. But on a daily basis, when I do a Google search, when I use Gmail, if I use Google Chat, they're constantly saying, do you want to give us the information about where you're located? And I know from the work of one of the founders of Move On, who published a book earlier this year and talked about what the 70 different search criteria that are collected from the cookies that are a part of every search query and response. So should we fear the amount of data that Google has collected on each of us individually, even though they say it's not linked directly to my name? Well, they know my IP address, and so they can collect this data and correlate it in ways that are frighteningly focused and specific. So, what level of concern should we have about the amount of data that Google collects on us and the way they use it?
I think we should be concerned, and we should demand transparency from Google on what information it has and how it uses it. And Google does try, let us know that, in ways that are a little beyond, fine print in those, complicated agreements that, no one reads. But also, to be careful about, in a way, what could happen to this information if the government gets it. We have to be careful about that, because Google says, we do this with it, we don't do this with it, we wait for your permission on this. But then, of course, any company that has so much information about us from various sources, they might not have that much of that information together to get a complete dossier on you. But if the government subpoenaed that information, the government would be able to do that there. And this isn't just a concern with Google. It's a concern really internet-wide from all the different ways we have to be tracked. And, on the other hand, there's a philosophy going, and the chief proponent of this really is Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook, that the privacy as we know it really is somewhat antiquated, that we're going to get more value if we share things with other people. And, Facebook's philosophy is, if you really want not to share everything, they'll let you hold some things back. But they feel very strongly that it's good for you to share more things. and, you know, and not to hold on to a version of privacy, which, you know, is based on, you know, holding things back and then deciding what to show, but the opposite, you know, of showing everything and then maybe deciding, you know, there might be certain things I don't want to show later on.
But let me ask you about this, because
I think Google is in the center of these big debates we're having about really what the future of privacy is and where we're going to stand on that. And some of the answers, you know, are going to rest with Google, but some of them are really going to be answered by, you know, what people demand from the government in terms of laws and regulations.
But Google Plus is being marketed as having enhanced privacy protections as compared to Facebook, because you've got greater control over exactly who you're sharing a given post with. But isn't that illusory? Isn't that just a marginal difference or a marketing benefit that, bottom line, isn't, you know, these two services are not that different? And in particular, on the amount of information they collect on the users.
Well, there's you know, I think that, you know, Google Circles is what you're referring to, and it's part of Google Plus that enables you to more easily determine, you know.
Yeah, I don't want my mom to see that picture of me drunk.
But you're right. I mean, basically, Google Plus does generate more information that does live with Google, and I think that of concern would be not so much that this information would be like leaked out to other people publicly, but just the information exists that could be used, subpoenaed, or maybe at some point Google's servers could be compromised. They put a lot of energy into computer security, but no company is perfect on that. It is a concern that we should have about just the how much information is out about us. And it's like Pogo. The enemy is us, really. If you go on there to Facebook or Google Plus or Twitter or anything else, and you start sharing all the minutia of your life, there's consequences to that in terms of what people know about you. And, people owe it to themselves to be aware of that and informed about that. And, of course, you know, also aware about how this information can be used in the marketing of it. Now, Google believes very strongly that if marketers are able to give you the information that's relevant to you, you're going to like it. And that's worked in search, but it's not so clear that that's going to work in terms of display ads or other kinds of advertising. And it's going to be, I think, something that people should have the right to choose.
Also, Google News allows me to select out if I don't want to hear about Rick Perry calling Social Security a Ponzi scheme. I can basically just select out that I don't want to hear from Rick Perry or Michelle Bachmann. But that skews the sense of what news really is. Not that anyone should be forced to listen to the ravings of people they don't care for. But as citizens, we need to have a baseline understanding of what political leaders who are potentially next presidents stand for. And if we purely use internet-based news services, A, we'll know more about Casey Anthony than Rick Perry, and B, we'll be able to select out of things that we either aren't interested in or that we find distasteful.
Well, you know, I actually feel that, you know, when you're watching, television news, you get bombarded with Casey Anthony, and you have no control over it. We have to accept some responsibility too. There, I mean, I don't watch the morning shows on television because they're full of the Casey Anthony and things like that, and the hosts riding roller coasters and things like that. I get newspapers. I look at the web, and I feel that, it might not be as fun to read about what's happening in Libya than it is to hear what Charlie Sheen's doing up there. But, that's up to me there. I actually feel, in this case, services like Google give us the ability to learn about everything at a bigger depth than we had before. And we have to take some responsibility for that. If I want to block out everything about the election or everything about what's happening in the Middle East or whatever. That's something that I really have to answer for, and I think that maybe we should go in deeper, and we should have schools which encourage curiosity in people, and learning about the world should be something which is just more highly valued than it is now. And I think you're just shooting the messenger if you say, well, it's Google's fault that they let you block something out on Google News, and it's quite the opposite. If you want to learn about the world, Google's going to help you do that.
I think that's a very good argument. Stephen Levy, the author of In the Plex, How Google Thinks, Works, and Shapes Our Lives. I highly recommend this book. It's fascinating, and you really should know what they're up to and how it will shape our future. Stephen Levy, also a senior writer at Wired Magazine. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Peter B. Collins Show. Send me an email, humblehost@peterbcollins.com. Happy trails.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.